I can see why people like to reread this one. Because after you know what's coming, you can really enjoy those intricacies.
Totally.
Like, just trying to keep straight all the different little...
Yeah.
It's like, what?
All the names?
Yeah. Like, all the couples and... What? No, I swear, in part two, there was something about a footman, and, you know, like, there was this staged thing where the guy is pulling out his intestines, but he's not really dying. Because...
Oh, yeah.
It was just, he faked it.
Yeah, yeah.
Was that the scene where they come across, it was supposed to be a wedding?
Yeah.
And the woman actually loved another...
Yeah.
Another guy, and then he faked stabbing himself, and then and by that they were able to get together again. And Don Quixote was the one making a speech about how... like love conquers all, that they should be truly together.
Yeah. But it seemed like there were details where if we knew what was going on, we'd realize that people from part one are showing up in part two. That we were on. Yeah.
One thing I wondered about with the whole elaborate nobility and all of them crafting all these ideas. Was it not the theater troupe that they encountered earlier? Or was it not? Like
they
all
were
had
the theater troupe were the ones acting in these kind of put on.
Yeah.
I didn't even think of that. That's...
That was one thing that kind of popped into my head of, that maybe, you know, this is all created and is coming back from the earlier parts.
You know, that's funny you say that, because that kind of is what happens in the movie.
Oh, really?
Yeah, kind of. Yeah.
I got the movie and I downloaded it and then I never watched it.
Well, if you do, keep that in mind.
It's really interesting how the movie is able to convey the essence of the book, though. And I didn't think about it until I started watching it a second time. But that it seems like Gilliam, he groks Don Quixote, and I really sensed it when David was talking about it, because he didn't have any, like, he understood what Gilliam was trying to convey. But he didn't have any of the book reference. And so it's just like, but like he was saying all the same things. It's like, wow, like the, whatever it is that's being conveyed is there. With the idea of like false identity or the alternate reality.
Yeah, I've been thinking a lot about like this idea that people say that Don Quixote is a book way before its time, but maybe that's just another myth. You know, maybe it's like we have the sense that it's before its time, but maybe it wasn't. Like Shakespeare was doing similar things. Like in Hamlet, you have a play within a play. And different things within Shakespeare's plays like that. Like, you find these ideas challenging reality all the way through these older books. So maybe there was a...
It might have
maybe
been...
Maybe it's just...
They're
it's
both
just in cycles or something, right? Like a...
Well, they're theater guys, and so maybe these were, like, things that they were exploring.
Like, the whole world's a stage, like that kind of idea. You
right.
Know, that,
I also think on some level too, I'm simultaneously read Zen and The Art of Motorcycle Maintenance.
Sure.
Because I'm doing a book club with my grandfather and my cousin, and that's one that we read.
Oh, awesome.
That's
it's pretty awesome. He's 95, so
yeah.
we're all chatting. But I like, there's some parts in there about technology and how it's separating us as a society, and there's I feel like with books, too, often can feel that because they were from the past, they should, their themes shouldn't relate to how we're feeling now. But mm-hmm. often they do. There's often these themes that when you look back at it, it's like, well, gosh, I wish we would have gotten over that. Or I thought maybe we were in a place where we understood more and had more tools to combat some of those challenges that happened then and are still happening now.
Yeah, it's like it just seems like the reason why these books still exist, like people still read them, is that these themes, they were so great in expressing these themes that the questions are still relevant.
Mm-hmm. We're still working them out, the details out.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Well, I don't know that we ever make enough. So, like, when I told you I just talked to Jeffrey Kripal, it must have been last week, and I was saying how, like, one of the things 42 Minutes does is this book club, and I tried to convey how important I feel it is. Because we're doing something that, for whatever reason, I feel is like of the utmost importance. Like this is, these are the things that somehow will save us. If we're gonna find any solace, it's in fiction.
I totally agree. I think that's awesome. I completely agree with that. It's the only way.
Yeah. But it's bizarre because it's like fiction and myth. These are like words that mean like lies, or they contain both, you know? It's like
they have at some point
the ultimate truth is not true, you know? It's like
Well, that, at some point, that's what those words get transformed into meaning, you know, untruth, you know. But I think that wasn't always the case, that they originally myths were more true than true, you know, more real than real, you know, expressing something eternal or timeless. Wow. Okay, there's some affirmation there.
That's Doug's, I think.
That was Doug?
Nah, that's Doug's dog. It's not Lacey's wild.
No, not my goats.
Yeah, it sounds like your goats have all gone to bed.
They have. There's none out there. Oh, no, there's one. I see. They're all tech.
Lacey, do coyotes go after goats?
They do, but there's not a lot of trees near the farm, so there's no place for them to come down from the mountains and sneakily come across. Mm. So
I have heard that goats, I mean, they can butt so strongly that they do, that they're not defenseless. Like,
no, yeah. I mean, I'm still learning, but it seems like they could hold their own.
Yeah.
But this is like...
I saw a coyote carrying a baby fawn a couple days ago.
Wow, really?
Yeah, a small coyote. It was nuts. It was kind of... Huh.
That's wild.
Yeah.
With goat herding, do people have dogs that they keep sometimes? Or...
I think so.
Yeah.
There aren't... the owners have dogs, but they're not herding the goats at all.
Border collie?
I think one is like a border collie mix, yeah, but he's kind of the old guy that just hangs out and watches the world go by.
Are you going to get a trailer cat?
What's a trailer cat?
I don't know.
Gotcha. I thought that was like some piece of equipment. Like a bobcat.
There are two cats that roam the property. One's like a total barn cat. And in the last week, they've brought me mouse heads.
Nice.
Yeah.
Wow, that's a great offering.
It was very surprising. Well,
what would you like
you into the tribe?
Yeah. Bestow you with
treasures.
Have you written any pastoral poetry yet?
No, I will. I'll figure out something. That's just to share with you guys.
Right on, yeah.
Do you have a hankering to read something, Lacey?
No, I didn't read all the descriptions of the list that you put out. And everything that we've read or that I've participated in, I've enjoyed. So I'll go with whatever. I didn't read Ada though. That one I could do.
Yeah, that's fine.
Thanks.
All right, Dennis, you, what's your vote?
I mean, I thought more about it. I like Ursula Le Guin a lot. I mean, I'm curious what you guys would think of some of her writing, because at times I found it I don't know, not quite as rich as some, but also like I think that the meat of it is really important. I'm game for whatever. I read a couple Ingo Swann books, and I'm still working through. I'm only halfway through Against the Day, the Thomas Pynchon, and I.
You've been reading on that, bro.
I know. I'm not finishing it, and I started JR, and I'm not very far into that. A while back.
All right.
So I don't know. I'm game for whatever.
Yeah, I'm really curious about the overstory.
Yeah.
If especially if we could get Alex back on or other people back in.
I think he's read it.
Yeah, well, he's the one who suggested it.
Yeah, exactly.
I think. Yeah. So.
Yeah.
Sure, I bet we could.
So that might be something that SJ's point too, that we could it's when was it written? Just the last few years, right? So
well, it won last year's. So
last
it,
year, okay.
It's the Pulitzer from last year, 2018. Mm. And the best novel ever written about trees, and really just one of the best novels, period.
Mm.
Wow!
Yeah. See,
that's lofty.
I love trees, so that's it. That kind of description appeals to me.
Yeah.
Let's do it.
All right, ready? The overstory.
Yeah. Sweet.
Great.
We'll do Ursula K. Le Guin sometime for sure.
What was your thought on Huxley, Doug?
Yeah, where did that come from? Where'd your
Kripal Esalen?
Yeah.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
Anyone in particular? Like we mentioned, well, I think as
I've never read any of the Huxley at all. So.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, really? Okay. Those are my books in high school. I went through a ton of Huxley in high school. I loved it. Mm.
Yeah, and they would probably be pretty good summer books, actually.
Sure.
Yeah, Island is especially a great one.
Yeah, I'd like to read that at some point.
But I mean, I don't think the overstory is like 38 hours. You know, I think it's more of a normal 8 to 12 hour book.
Yeah, let's check.
I'm looking.
Let's see in here. Amazon.
20 some hours.
Is it?
Yeah, I think it's 22 hours. Something like that.
Maybe it's bigger than I realize.
Well, I have 21 hours left, so my little dot is right near the beginning.
Oh, it has 512 pages.
All right.
It's kind of meaty.
Yeah.
But at least it will be written in modern English, right?
But I think some of the characters are trees, and so I don't know. I mean,
really?
Yeah.
There used to be this guy. Well, I remember hearing stories that the Aboriginal people would talk about certain races, certain groups of people that chose to incarnate as trees to get away from the people that were oppressing them in human form, and then those oppressors took form of a competing trees, and then the trees were fighting under the ground. Roots were there's a whole mythology about it. And
wow, that sounds good.
Yeah,
it's like the Battle of the Trees. That's what's his name? Robert Graves talks about that. Like the,
oh, really?
Yeah.
I think there's a Rush song about that too. I'm not kidding.
There's another book called The Hidden Life of Trees that's supposed to be what goes on under the soil.
Is that the same guy who wrote The Hidden Life of Plants? Was that his first one? And then he wrote that one after?
I don't know. The Hidden Life of Trees is one that I've had and I just haven't read for...
I think people really like that book. I heard it mentioned.
I'm just trying to find if there's a Don Quixote connection to the Overstory, which would make it perfect. But you see, Quixote. Okay, here's an interview with him on the Guardian, I guess. Which classic novel did you read recently for the first time? I came back this year to Don Quixote. I found it tremendously entertaining when I was young and terribly sad now at the age of 61.
Oh, that's funny.
That's crazy.
Of course.
Okay, well, good. We're all in agreement.
All right, I have to go flip some cheese.
Flip some cheese?
That's the Flappity Zoo. Whatever. The equivalent.
Yeah, there you go. Thanks, guys. Have a great night. Yep.
Yeah. Night, folks. Bye.
Bye.
Who's still here?
Over it.
Just you and me.
Dennis is off now. Okay, yeah. I should get out too, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah. All right, I can put this big book in the shelf and let it sit for a little while longer.
Wait, you didn't say, you still haven't said what was your favorite part of the second.
You know, the second half, there were so many, I think I was always remarking on how the adventures just felt so much more ingenious in the second part.
Right.
Like the lions, I really was in that. I couldn't believe that, you know, I just kept waiting for him to get attacked by the lions.
Yeah.
But there were a lot of those little adventures were like that.
Yeah, I've been reading about the kind of restraint that he has in the second half, right? With that episode of the lions, he didn't attack the lion keeper to get him to open the cage, and he didn't provoke the lion afterwards. He was content to just open the cage and let him out, and then he proved himself. You know, like he shows a lot more restraint in the second half.
He being Don Quixote or Cervantes?
Yeah, Don Quixote. Yeah,
it really is odd to consider these things like one thing, because they really are quite different, even though, you know, they come to us as one thing.
Yeah, you see little hints of it even in this in part one, where it's a lot more self-aware than what we usually think. Like I think if it was only the part one that existed, maybe people wouldn't have noticed that as much. But there is, after reading part two, you can sort of see that there's a kind of a meta level to part one as well. Mm. Not as explicit, right? Mm-hmm. Mm.
But I definitely sensed, like, part one was, the humor was more on the surface, and then it was a lot more comic, or not comic, brutal. Like there yeah. was the Tom and Jerry.
Yeah, for sure. That's exactly it.
Where it's that kind of. Tom and Jerry never, well, maybe it's Itchy and Scratchy, where they just always are fine in the next scene, you know?
Mm, yeah. Don Quixote is not perfectly fine. He's still, he's missing all his teeth and et cetera, but yeah, it's like that. Like he always gets up ready to go again.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right.
But, you know, I was actually thinking about this. It's almost like, so I, towards the end of my college career, I enjoyed being in college. I liked taking something on for a period of time and like just being in that space. And so like when we're doing a book, I'm listening to the music of the time, you know, and just thinking about like just trying to be like, it was the same with the Virginia Woolf, where I was just kind of in that headspace for a time, and I don't know, it's funny, but this is kind of like doing a college class a little bit, where we're reading the book, but we're also just seeing where it leads us, and you know what kind of interesting things we pick up.
Yeah, yeah, and then we're going beyond that even, and seeing this kind of interconnected.
Oh yeah.
Weirdness that comes from our sync studies, probably, right? Like,
right. Why? How are these different things? Well, that was the interesting thing about listening to David, where he was saying, so this media is important, but I don't think we really get, you know, the really important meanings until you start layering all these different things together. Like, when he was explaining that, it was like, oh, yeah, that's really interesting, where like just the one meaning of whatever creation it is that you're looking at by itself is not enough, that until you start stacking these different things together that you really
get,
you really get the importance of what's there.
Right, right. And then the more you get into literature in general, the easier it is to do that, you know.
Yeah, but, and that's kind of what we're doing.
Yeah.
And I didn't even realize it until just now that, like, by stacking these books on top of each other, we're able to let them bleed into each other.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because it's...
Well,
yeah.
That line last time when David came in and you said... it feels like Don Quixote has joined us. and then you made the connection between knight errantry and sync. And I thought that was perfect. Like that was excellent, you know? And there is a sense like Don Quixote really, he becomes disillusioned towards the end and his body gets sick. And then finally while he's dying, he snaps out of his delusion, so-called, and then starts to realize it was all just a fantasy, right? But there's that kind of sense that we can get into the point. Maybe this is the kind of pre-2012 thing again, where you can get to the point where there is this belief, right? And then that holds everything together. This whole kind of crazy web of synchronicity. It was held together by that kind of like belief of a final convergence or something, and then when that was taken away, it's kind of, yeah, that's the moment when Don Quixote realizes that that there's an enchantment that's fallen on Dulcinea and he can no longer see her anymore, you know? And to be able to see her again unenchanted is the real struggle, you know? And in a way it's almost beyond that. It's like being able to see her again unenchanted while realizing that she's not there, you know, like she's really not there. But that there's something even more powerful than I don't know the reason behind it, you know. If that makes sense.
Yeah.
Like to get back to that kind of, like 2012 was kind of, it's an interesting thing, like the whole McKenna thing in Mayan calendar and everything else on top of that, right? And it got people to this. It just almost became an anchoring point for the imagination or something. And then when that anchor was taken off, it was like, what is there to latch onto again? And the whole thing kind of dissipated to some extent. But I always wonder what would have happened if McKenna had had likened it more to poetry than trying to put a scientific spin on it, where he's trying to exactly calculate it to a certain date, and when that date didn't happen, then the whole thing falls apart, you know. But if it was just this open-ended thing that there's this convergence to come at some point, you know, then does the faith keep going, you know? Do you see what I mean?
Yeah. Well, so. Right, so like, I think in the Torah, weren't they saying that Elijah never, like, they're still waiting for Elijah to come,
but
Jesus is saying, no, I was the, I don't know if Jesus said that, but maybe his followers said that he was the prophecy.
Yeah, then you have. In Islam, saying Muhammad's the last prophet. Although you have in Shia Islam, you have this idea of the imams coming, the final imam to come or whatever. But even in Christianity, Jesus comes back, you know? Like there's always this thing to... it's an interesting thing. Like, can you believe in Dulcinea yet know that she's enchanted? And then the whole idea of enchantment is not real, you know. But really believe that actually that realm of the imagination is more real than anything that reason can consider, you know.
Well, so that's, I mean, so if we're going to get really fanciful, so like in my... I think 10 years ago, I was thinking about the same things. And it's really sad because not much has changed in 10 years. And so, so I was thinking about the environment and how we live and how we could, you know, is there a way that humans can live that isn't going to degrade the planet and each other? And, you know, could we move in that direction? And... Mm-hmm. Like, I think there was one moment where we didn't put up a ton of carbon into the atmosphere, and that was when we had the economy almost completely collapse in 2008.
Right. Yes.
Yeah. And, you know, like, the only thing that prevents the end of the world was the end of the world, basically.
Interesting. Yeah. That period was interesting too. Like the economy falls apart, and it's kind of like almost falls apart, and you realize at that point that that's the only thing keeping, like, not only the economy together, you know, that's the only thing keeping reality together at this point, you know, because there's nothing else. There's no medieval Christian superstructure that people consider to be ultimate truth anymore. That's all gone, you know. The only thing that keeps society together is constant distraction and shopping, you know?
Yeah. Well, so 10 years ago, I really latched onto this idea that we're not going to be able to intellectually solve these problems, or that's what I thought at that time. That the answer was mystical, like that was the only, because I was thinking more in line with, I don't know if it was an Einstein quote, but we're not going to solve the problems we created with the same thinking.
Paradigm is, yeah.
And so I was really thinking, and so that I went off into synchromysticism thinking that this is where the solutions are. It's a mystical solution to, and so, you know, maybe like Neville Goddard, like imagination, like there could be some reality bending, like that would be, you know, maybe, maybe that could be a thing. I don't know. But, so it's interesting that you bring up 2010 or 2012 and dissipation. 'Cause it really feels like this summer, a lot of the environmental writing is like really just so heavy. And it's like facing the fact that, we've crossed this point, and now it's just a matter of how bad things will get in the next in the next years. And so it's really interesting. I just don't know. It feels dark right now.
Yeah, to me it also feels dark. It seemed, although it seems slightly less dark than it has been over the last few years, like just the last maybe 4 years or something, it seems like there's a slight glimmer of hope out there somehow. I don't know how it's irrational hope or something.
That's interesting, because so like it's so funny because all these things are happening on different levels, and so you, if you think about like different, like you even said that, you know, like after World War II, man, everything was just destroyed, right? Like everyone was, the cultures are broken and people are broken. Or maybe even between World War I and World War II. But as far as like thinking about the consumer machine, you know, extracting value from everything, it was just getting started in like 1945. Like really,
yeah,
you know, like extracting whatever from whatever resource, yeah.
The mechanical bride, right? Like that's when it starts, right?
And so like even in the 70s, and you've got like Nixon, and it just seems like, you know, things are coming apart where society, or like in 1968 we're murdering presidents and stuff, you know, where we're having constitutional crises or whatever, but even then, you know, like there's still so much pristine environment out there that we haven't destroyed yet. So like in terms of like this pastoral looking back, I can see where that comes from. It's like, oh yeah. You know, like they made this movie in 1982 called Koyaanisqatsi, and it's all about
Koyaanisqatsi.
Yeah. It's life out of balance. And, like there's,
it's just getting more out of balance.
It just like, it just speeds up. Like things, it's just so, it's so weird to be like even 10 years down the road from 2009 when, you know, I was like entering into synchromysticism. And
well, and then the whole like the intervening thing where synchromysticism is basically taken over by the alt-right in a way and transformed to memetic magic, you know, like and it was meme magic that brought down Hillary, you know, and ushered in Trump, you know. It's insane, you know, like there's a direct link with that, you know, like it was talked about explicitly on Red Ice Radio, you know, the connection of synchromysticism and meme magic. But So it's we ushered in Trump.
And then somehow Trump is like the Don Quixote, like he exists in that world so well.
Yeah. So that's the thing, right? Like, so if Don Quixote is not ahead of its time, and it's only tapping into these kind of universal questions that exist constantly throughout literature, right? Then it becomes a different thing, right? Because it's no longer just historical, right? These writers and poets and artists are tapping into the same, the same crisis of reality that now everybody's seeing, you know? So I think that's why those kind of books still speak to us, you know?
Yeah, I wonder, like, if that's more about, like, institutional breakdown, where we don't trust anything. As far as, like, what you were talking about, this medieval worldview and a structure to fall back on,
mm-hmm.
and what we have is shopping and distraction.
Right. Yeah. No, it's I live in Japan, and it's only that, you know, there's no, just constant consumerism here, you know. But it's like that over the West too. If there is a sustained economic collapse, right? It's a because of that, you know, because of that, what we're just talking about. Then it becomes almost like a metaphysical collapse, you know, metaphysical breakdown for the world, right? It's a metaphysics not based on any sort of religious ideology or anything. It's a metaphysics based on consumerism, you know. And then that breaks down, and then what's left after that, you know, like what opens up after that, you know? Kind of the last veil falls, and what do we see? So I don't know, that could be the changing point, but then I always like, can that even happen without war, you know? Like that's in the past, that's what's happened when huge financial collapses have occurred. A war follows from them, you know, or coincide, the two coincide together, you know. So it is pretty dark,
The war actually is like another way, you were talking about usury, it's like this is a way, like we need this kernel to animate existence, whether it's like we create money, we make it up, and then you can give people money and they can do stuff. Like, mm-hmm. you know, like sail to another land and find stuff. Or if we go to war with someone, then you have people back home and they can make guns and tanks and whatever it is they need to. It's like, it's the story that animates. It's a reason why.
Yeah. And then, yeah, of course, the banking industry and the weapons industry are the one thing, basically. No, I was just reading also about Ezra Pound and Joyce, and how Ezra Pound kind of really criticized Joyce, especially when he was writing Finnegan's Wake, because Pound is like, you're completely out of it now. Like, you're not talking about anything that's happening in the present at all. You're just off in your own who knows what. You
but
know?
That's
like,
what
you
I'm talking about, the it. Mystical solution, though.
Well, yeah, and so that's Joyce's answer to Pound. It's like he's saying in Finnegan's Wake, patience, patience, patience. That's the virtue, you know, because we have no idea what's going to happen in the future. We have no idea what part of the cycle that we're actually on. We have an idea that we're near the end in this collapse. We all know what happens after the collapse. It continues on again, you know. So it's but even then, there are cycles within cycles, and we have really and there are unexpected things that occur all the time, you know. So it's like to give in to doom and gloom is obviously not the answer either, you know.
Well, so that's what's interesting, because I think just recently I decided I enjoy Slavoj Žižek, but as far as what ultimately where he lands, I don't know that I agree with the, you know, this his elites that are gonna change society.
Right, right. No, I don't rock with that part of his thinking either.
But it is funny, because I do think society and maybe it's both corporations and politicians have tried to personalize all these problems. And so instead of thinking societally or having any sense of commons, you know, all the ills of the world are placed upon us as individual citizens.
Yeah, yeah.
You know,
you should, yeah. Like you said before, we should recycle our straws and have shorter showers
and
cut our hair at home and like whatever. Yeah.
But I think like our personal debts are the same way, where like, and I don't know, I mean, maybe that was on a talk, but like, or maybe it was anyway, like I've always blamed myself, like, oh, I don't handle money well. And it's like, no, all these lenders, like they're designed to like put you in this situation where they own you, where you're like the slave, right? That's
right,
just,
right.
Like, I think it would take like a Superman to not somehow get, I don't know.
Well, again, like that's in Shakespeare and Hamlet. It's like, stay out of debt, you know. It's another thing that Pound was saying in all these old works of literature, that there's a theme of that, you know. It's like they give really practical advice on how to live in that way, you know.
What did we, neither a lender nor a...
A borrower be.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, the only... I forget who said this. Was it Jefferson or something? Like this, Pound brings out all these people who have spoken against usury all through history. And Jefferson, like the American founding fathers were all speaking against it, right? So I think it... I don't know. I can't remember exactly who it was, but somebody was saying... the only people who should lend money are the people who have money to lend, you know, and that's what it is in a nutshell, right? Like banks they don't have the money to lend. They're just making money from nothing. And that's the essence of the problem.
Yeah.
But you can't see how it will change through politics or anything else, and unless it's a mass popular movement that has that as their understanding, you know. But it's not going to happen through politicians, because nobody of any party is going to get to the level where they could get the presidency or even become a representative. Who has that kind of, you know, I want to take down the banks and the media and the military industrial complex. And,
yeah. And that's why, like, it's easy to fall into like that hopelessness. It's like, well, these forces are just so big, and to move them just even a little bit in the direction where you want to go is so much time and effort. Yeah.
And so then that goes back to what we were saying before. It's like, so we have to find our own narrative to get out of that, right? To get out of the narrative of despair.
Yeah.
Because if you look at it from that point of view, like if news and the daily feed of the daily grind is your only source of information, which it is for most people, and for me too, right? But if that's your only source of information, then it is despair. It is total hopelessness and helplessness, right? But then if you go beyond and you start to look into literature and poetry and these other things, you know, and you find these kind of timeless themes, then it allows you to stand outside, you know. It's kind of an anti-environment, like McLuhan was talking about. And then that's kind of a region of hope, you know. So yeah, I agree with you when you say this is the most important thing. Anyway, we're restoring the golden age.
We're trying.
Yeah. Fools on our horses.
Tilting windmills.
Yeah. Okay, I gotta tilt the toilet seat, I think.
To bring us back to part one, yeah.
Okay, it's great to talk to you as always.
All right, look forward to the overstory, and yeah, you have a good day.
Okay. Right, good night. See you around.
Okay, bye bye.
And now the purple dusk of twilight time steals across the meadows of my heart. High up in the sky, the little stars climb, always reminding me that we're apart. You wander down the lane and far away, leaving me a song that will not die. Love is now the stardust of yesterday, the music of the years gone by. Sometimes I wonder why I spend the lonely night dreaming of a song. The melody haunts my reverie, and I am once again with you when our love was new. And each kiss an inspiration, but that was long ago. Now my consolation is in the stardust of a song beside a garden wall. When stars are bright, you are in my arms. The nightingale tells his fairy tale, a paradise where roses bloom, though I dream in vain. In my heart it will remain, my stardust melody, the memory of love.